But I've read your book.
Okay.
And so I was absolutely intrigued and enthralled by it. Now, I can't say I understood it, but I was so amused. There were so many funny things about it. So I want to ask you a couple of questions, not only about yourself and your background and how you write and why you write, but I want to ask you about what you're doing in the Medusa frequency, because it's funny and it's baffling at the same time. It's really kind of a modernistic retelling of Orpheus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a retelling of the story of Orpheus and Eurydice by the very unreliable head of Orpheus.
Whose head materializes in things like a grapefruit.
Grapefruit, a cabbage, a stone. Hermann Orff, the narrator of the story, recognizes the head of Orpheus as a hallucination until the head says, "You think I'll go away if you stop thinking me?" And he says, "Yes, I do." He says, "What if I stop thinking you?" And when the head of Orpheus stops thinking him, he very nearly has a heart attack on the spot. So he's dependent on something that originates in his own mind.
I see that Hermann at one point had worked for Slythe and Tovey.
Yes.
Which sounds like something out of Lewis Carroll.
Yeah, it was Brillig and the Slithy Toves, the guy in Gimbal and the Wave.
Your earlier book, Ridley Walker, was notable because of the very original language in it, and of course the Medusa frequency makes use of, well, is it the same language? Tell me about this. Sometimes you'd be reading a paragraph and all of a sudden you come to words that seem to make sense in the context of the paragraph, but when you think about it, you're not sure exactly what they did mean.
Well, for example?
Well, they're all throughout here. Let's see. I have to. Incidentally, there were some really pretty lines. There was one I just loved here. If I could find it without having to spend a lot of time, I should have marked some of these pages, but some of the writing is absolutely poetic. And so pretty, and makes sense. Didn't you use the term novembering in here? Novembering, which is not normally used in the way you used it, but absolutely worked beautifully in the context in which you used it. Oh, let's see. You want an unusual word in the middle of a paragraph or a phrase.
You said that...
Or language.
There are places where it doesn't... Where the language seems... The usual sort of thing, but it doesn't make sense. Or where the language is straight language, but you don't understand what it means.
No, not the straight language. The unusual words that you use, you have apparently created your own.
I say, give me an example.
Okay, well, I'm looking here.
You don't put markers in books, eh?
No, I should. I'm pretty casual about this. Since
still, for retrieving data.
Yeah, you're right. I can't. How's next Wednesday for you? Can I pencil you in? Genext, Mimph, I said, as what felt like an iron fist pushed heavily against my sternum.
Well, there's nothing confusing about that. He explained that he makes his living writing comics and that he tends to hear all sounds in expressionistic capital letters. And we've already seen that he tends to experience angina pectoris in moments of anxiety, so there's nothing confusing about that.
Okay. Well, let's find another one that you can explain to me, all right? Let's see. Well, maybe you've explained it. A lot of these...
There's almost nothing that doesn't explain itself in context.
Yeah, like before the big wish, snick ya into the blood...
Snick.
I'm sorry. Didn't mean to mispronounce that. Into the blood hole went Nevesnu the Trunsk.
Nevesnu the Trunsk. Well, he's describing a fantasy comic strip, which, again, is explained as it is narrated. There's nothing confusing about that.
In your earlier book, Ridley Walker, tell me about that and tell me about how you developed the language for that book.
I began to write it in straight English, and it simply began to slide into a vernacular, which isn't all that out of the ordinary. Essentially, it is simply lower-class English where the auxiliary verbs are omitted. Instead of saying, I have gone, I have done, people say, I gone, I done. And big words break into two bits, and other words are blurred, so they change somewhat. New words are stuck in. As I was writing, I kept word lists of anything that deviated from standard English and kept it consistent.
The novels that are your adult novels, I think novels, fiction, and in any event, is almost like a puzzle, isn't it? A game, a word game. Some writers do it well, and some are very inventive. There are people like yourself, like Coover, like William Gass, who can play with words and create these marvelously complex word puzzles. In many respects, that's what fiction is, isn't
it? No, I don't think it's a word game. I don't think I write puzzles. I use language, however, I have to tell what I'm telling about. There's no game involved. As far as I know, the reality that we move in every day has to be decoded. I mean, the brain is busy decoding it all the time. The visual cortex is decoding what the eyes take in. Other parts of the brain are decoding the data that come in. So there's always a natural kind of decoding that's going on. If my use of words seems unusual, it's only because so many writers use words in a clunkish way simply to convey chunks of experience, just to move information around in the simplest way. The words themselves have no color, flavor, density, texture. They are simply data packages.
You wrote children's books many years, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about, how did you get into children's literature?
At the time that I fell into it, I was a freelance illustrator, and I used to do drawings and paintings for my own pleasure. And I used to drive around Connecticut, where I lived, making sketches and paintings of construction machinery because I found it beautiful. And some of our friends thought that my drawings were the sort of thing that would make a good children's book, and got me an introduction to Ursula Nordstrom, who was then head of the Harper Department of Books for Boys and Girls, and she gave me a contract to do a book on construction machinery. So that was how I became a published author. I illustrated that book myself. I illustrated one more book myself on an atomic submarine. After that, I drifted into a kind of little didactic tale involving some small family conflict, which was resolved plausibly and entertainingly, and the characters were always anthropomorphic animals, and I was no good at doing cuddly animals myself. So Garth Williams illustrated the first book of that kind, and then my wife Lillian Hoban illustrated the following ones.
When did your first adult book develop?
Well, really, my first adult book, as far as I was concerned, was the novel called The Mouse and His Child. It was published as an adult book. It was published as a children's book because I didn't think I had a chance of getting it published as an adult book, as the protagonists were two clockwork mice. So as I already had an in at Harper's Children's Books, I took it there and they published it. But my first recognizably adult novel was The Lion of Boaz Jacob and Jacob Boaz, which was published in, I think it was 1973.
How difficult was it to get out of the image, the mold of being a children's writer and into one recognized as an adult fiction writer?
Not at all. It never occurred to me that I was going to spend the whole of my life doing 10-page typescripts for children's picture books. All of my children's books, with the exception of The Mouse and His Child, which was 200-odd pages, were picture books, a page of text facing a page of picture. And I couldn't imagine that a grown man should spend his whole life doing that. I grew up assuming that development is a continuing process in art and in oneself.
You were born in Pennsylvania. What did your parents do?
Both of my parents came from Russia to the U.S., and my father was advertising manager at the Jewish Daily Forward in Philadelphia. My mother, for a hobby, which turned into more of a business, raised pigeons and sold the squabs to restaurants, hospitals, caterers. So we had 2,000 pigeons out and back in two long pigeon houses.
A literary household?
Not that anybody wrote, but my father, I suppose, would qualify as an intellectual. he was the director of the Drama Guild of the Workmen's Circle in Philadelphia. So we had a library. I was the only child in those parts who lived in a house where there was a room called the library, and that was solely for the containing and use of books. He had shelves full of Yiddish and Russian and English plays. There was always a model stage set on top of the bookshelves. He had all kinds of books. It was a time of self-improvement, particularly among immigrants. And we had Dr. Eliot's 5-foot shelf, the Harvard Classics, of which every volume remained new and virgin, except Vol 17, which was Folklore and Fable, and that's the one that I read pretty well to death. That had Aesop's Fables, and it had Grimm and Andersen.
So you were, of course, having the exposure to books. You obviously became my son, I also live in a library. Every room in the house is loaded with books, but my son grew up without reading. He had absolutely no interest in it, but you were a reader.
I was a reader. I remember, I think, aside from the Grimm and Andersen, when I first experienced the luxury of the written word, was reading Oscar Wilde. There was a volume called A House of Pomegranates that contained his famous fairy tales, The Happy Prince, The Selfish Giant, The Fisherman and His Soul, 7 or 8 of those. And that was where I first came across words that delighted in their texture and weight and density and color. You know, there were rooms with onyx and chalcedony, and there were pomegranates and all sorts of wonderful colors and flavors and textures.
Onyx, well, that is a pretty word, isn't it?
Yeah.
You obviously loved words, and yet you set out to be an artist.
Well, it happened that I drew very well from the age of 5, and I was also good with words. And my parents, being Jewish immigrants and full of that particular ethos of setting their children on the road to achievement, when they saw how well I drew, they were convinced that I was going to be a great painter, and they sort of climbed on my back with that. So I felt that I had to go as far as I could with it, but I found that my particular bent was more illustrative than what would be called fine arts. So I thought I might as well have a go and see what I can do with illustration. And I made my living as a freelance illustrator for 8 years. My best assignments were done for the Time Life group. I did a lot of things for Sports Illustrated. I did a number of Time covers. I did some things for Fortune, one job for Life. And during that time, I fell into the writing of children's picture book texts. And after a while, I found that I felt that I had paid my dues with being a great artist. I'd developed a certain reputation. I found that I liked writing more, so I slid out from under the illustration and spent more and more time with writing. And to bridge the gap, because there were not yet enough royalties to live on from the children's books, I got a job writing copy at Doyle Dane Burnback, where I spent a very happy 2 years, really nice people, a nice place to work, until 1967, when I was able to be a full-time writer.
Thank goodness you didn't have to work at Classic Comics.
Well, Classic Comics and advertising isn't too much difference.
You went to school where?
I went to school in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. I graduated high school, and after that I got a part scholarship to college. I was a proto-dropout. I went to Temple University for 5 weeks and dropped out, and transferred to art school, and went to art school for something over a year, and then went into the Army at the age of 18, and I was an infantry replacement.
Mm. So you spent a great deal of your formative career in the New York area then, huh?
Well, when I got out of the Army in 1945, I'd already got married, and my wife had found us a flat in New York City, and that's what I came back to from the Army. And we lived in New York City from exactly 10 years, from 45 to 55, although the last couple of years were in Brooklyn, where we moved after our first daughter was born.
You are now living in England?
Yes, in London.
When did you go over there? How did that happen?
I went to London in 1969 with my first wife and our children. intending a 2-year stay, and the marriage broke up there.
You had intended to go there for the experience of living abroad?
Well, not just the experience of living abroad, but because I simply had always assumed that I'd have a long stay in London sometime, because I liked English writers so much. Not just the major world-famous ones like Dickens and Trollope, but all kinds of odd little hole-in-the-corner writers like Sheridan Le Fanu, who's Irish rather than English, and Arthur Machen, and Algernon Blackwood, who... Algernon Blackwood is actually Canadian, I think, but he's published in England. M.R. James, Oliver Onions.
Yeah, I'm not up on those writers.
Not everyone is. They're beautiful writers, and they write in a genre that I've always found very appealing, ghost stories, supernatural stories.
So you wanted to give England a shot?
Yeah, that narrative voice, that way of writing, that mode of using words, simply was the most attractive way of using the English language to me, and I wanted to be in the place where it was done.
And you've been there ever since?
Been there ever since.
And you live in London?
Yeah.
Is there, well, what's it like for an American living there? Do you find the atmosphere hospitable?
Variably. What happens, I think, to everybody is that when a place becomes the place where tremendous things have happened to you and for you, that becomes your place. That becomes where it's happening for you. And sometimes you like it and sometimes you loathe it, but it's your place. So now I've got a second family. I have 3 sons who are Englishmen who are firmly plugged into the English education system. And London is where it continues to happen for me, where my work goes on. And yes, I suppose it's hospitable. And there's another phenomenon as well. I'm one of those people who's always felt himself to be a stranger in his native land. And it's comfortable to be a stranger where one really is a stranger.
Why have you felt a stranger in America?
Some people simply feel that way more than others. Some people feel themselves to be insiders. Some people feel themselves to be outsiders. It's a matter of how you experience human consciousness. And I'm beginning to think it's a matter of how you experience what is called reality. Most people operate in a limited reality consensus, where the table's real, the chair is real, the floor is real, but the ideas in your head aren't really real, and all kinds of things that you can't put your hand on or put a name to aren't really real. Well, the reality I operate in is one in where whatever is real.
Paul Theroux, who is a regular visitor to this broadcast, lives in London. Did you ever bump into him, by the way?
Yeah, I know Paul.
Paul has mixed feelings about the English, because he's married to...
Married to an English woman.
An English woman. But he is also critical. His book, The Kingdom by the Sea, was really a devastating critique of the English as opposed to other parts of the British Isles. But the aspersions that the English cast on Americans, on foreigners, on Jews, on blacks... he found appalling and got quite a bit of criticism in there for writing about it. What has been your experience? Is he accurate?
Was he accurate? I don't know. I haven't read the book. But there's an English writer named Linda Blandford who now lives over here and whose feature appears, I don't remember whether it's The Guardian or The Observer. But so she writes with some... asperity about Americans. I mean, that's the thing to do for a certain kind of writer. You take some good shots, you take some cheap ones. If you set yourself up as an observer of the human comedy in that way. I don't. I'm not a travel writer. You've had vast experience in this kind of thing. You know that writers have to keep writing, they have to keep selling books. So science fiction writers keep writing sci-fi, and my kind of writer keeps writing what I write, and Paul Theroux keeps writing the kind of thing that he writes. The kind of thing that he writes has to do with traveling and encountering people and having opinions about them.
Yeah, well, he's kind of hard to pin down. He is known as a travel writer. His last book happened to be a very large science fiction book. book before that was a collection of essays, and he's written a number of novels, so it's kind of hard to pin down. You heard the comments that James Purdy made about his English publishers. You're published both in England and in the United States. The people who publish in England need the United States as a market because England is small.
They do.
So tell me, what's your experience with your British publishers?
Well, now, when I was listening to James Purdy and he was talking about the awful British publishers, I said it was a load of bollocks because I have probably the best publisher there is, Tom Mashler. And I'm not going to talk about the finances of the thing, which are not on a grand scale. It's a nickel and dime operation compared to the advances that Mario Puzo and other giants of letters get. But what I thrive on is having a publisher who's all excited about what I'm going to show him next. That's where it's at for me. I don't have to have lunch with him at the Algonquin every day. I'm there in my little solitary place, pursuing my solitary vice at my solitary Apple II computer, and he's in his office talking to a million other people who are doing their thing. But I know that he's all excited to see the next thing I'm doing. And when I take it in, it doesn't go through five illiterates. It goes right to Tom Mashler, and he reads it, and he gets back to me very quickly, and he might have five specific comments, sometimes as technical as, why did you repeat this word five times on page 73? And sometimes, why did the whole feeling of the thing change in the middle the way it did? And sometimes I'll say, yeah, that's a point. And so I'll only repeat that word three times on page 73. And the other thing I'll say, I did it that way because, and I'll tell them why I did it. That's publishing as far as I'm concerned. When the big guy is right there to talk to you, and he tells you what he thinks, you tell him what you think, and you do it your way unless he convinces you that his suggestions are right.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to know, that your editor is deeply involved in your book and cares about it.
Yeah.
Because I've talked with Purdy as one example. I've talked to other writers who say they've submitted their manuscript, and sometimes they don't hear anything about it. They get no input. The editor leaves in midstream. Nobody cares about it, and there's no promotion at the end of it. And
you're not going to get me to knock British publishing, because that's where a whole life opened up for me, and where a publisher simply made me feel such a burst of confidence and interest in me that it's very supportive.
Well, I was very impressed. Well, I did an interview some time ago with Robert McCrum, I think his name is, a Faber and Faber, a very prestigious publishing house, literary publishing house, and he struck me as such a young guy, but so enthusiastic about good books, really good books. And he was listening to me the books that he wouldn't take, books that might earn them a fortune, but he wouldn't take them. It would diminish his publishing house. Well, let's go back to the nature of writing a little bit. You mentioned your Apple II. We have to upgrade you from that machine to a Macintosh one of these days.
Well, I suppose I'll have to eventually, because after a while I won't be able to get spare parts anymore. Already the people who have the maintenance of my machine told me they don't want to do it anymore because it's not economical for them.
Yeah, it is. It's an old line. The Apple Macintosh for a writer is sensational because it uses a whole bunch of different windows that you can call on for your notes, and it's really phenomenal machine.
There's a limit to how technical I want to get. All I want is to be able to move text around so I don't have to keep retyping to get a clean TypeScript.
Well, how does it work when you write? How did you conceive the Medusa frequency?
All of my books get started with some kind of a starter element, an image or an idea or an experience that is vivid for me and stays in my mind and attracts other things to it. I've always been interested in the idea of the severed head of Orpheus floating down the Hebrus to the sea and calling out for Eurydice. I mentioned it, I gave it a couple of pages in Kleinzeit, one of my earlier novels, and in the Medusa frequency, the starter element that combined with the head of Orpheus was a particular olive tree that I saw on the island of Paxos. It was a very ancient tree. It looked as if it was dead. It was a great gaping dark hole in the trunk, but it had live olives on the top of it. And the hole in the trunk was of such a kind that it made one think that perhaps a naked goddess had walked out of it into the green light of the olive grove. So that just kept working in my mind, and gradually other things gathered around it, and I tried it out, you know, got a couple of pages going, and then they weren't it, and tried it out a few more times. And eventually I got something that went on a bit further, and little by little got all the way to the end of its line.
The creative process is so elusive, it's difficult to know exactly how it works or why it works, and how people figure out the words that they want to put on paper. I was talking to John Irving a while back, who said that the first chapter he wrote for his last novel wound up being the last chapter. And as he looked at the whole span of his words, he conceived them differently and moved and shuffled them around. I don't know if he used an apple do, but he probably did, because it was a rather long book. So there is no way to determine. I mean, there's... For example, I don't think anybody could sit down and teach somebody to write. Somehow there has to be this burst of energy that somehow ends up manifesting itself on a page.
I don't think you can teach somebody to write. For 2 or 3 years, I did 2 or 3 workshops a year, and I ended up feeling that it was a corrupting experience both for the teacher and the student. It was a corrupting experience for the teacher because these people come to you. And in England, many of them are quite good with words. They've gone to university, and they're handy with the language. These people come to you because they can't make it happen for themselves, and they say, we will invest you with the magic power to make it happen for us. And you say, okay, and you make it happen for them. You make them able to write while they're in your group, and then they go home and they can't do it for themselves.
I think a lot of them like the idea of writing.
A lot of them like the idea of writing, but they're not obsessed by it. I always tell people, don't bother with writing unless you can stand not to do it. If you can stand not doing it, then don't do it.
You are obsessed by it.
Yeah, it's my main squeeze, you might say. It's my main form of living, mode of being.
Of course it is. You also read.
Not a lot. I avoid contemporary fiction because I don't want to know what other writers are doing. I don't want to be interfered with. I don't want to be working on some sort of a theme and then find out that another writer is working on the same theme. If I don't know about it, even if that writer is working on the same theme, we'll do different things. But if I do know about it, then I'll be uncomfortable.
I'm not sure how many other writers will be working on your themes, Russell Hoban. I think that... The listeners of this broadcast will get a kick out of the Medusa frequency. It's unusual. It's different. And I was absolutely fascinated by it. And I want you to know that the approach that I have is one that celebrates the word and books and writers, because I think writing is about the best thing you can do, anyone can do. So I'm going to give a positive report on the air to the Medusa frequency, and I would like very much to send you a cassette tape.
Please do.
In London, let you see that your words will reach out to many people in a way that you couldn't do otherwise with a different kind of broadcast.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for spending the time with me.
Been a pleasure.
Skeptic as you are.